Welcome back to the Mike McFeely Show here on KFGO. I'm your guest host, Clay Jenkinson. Mike is on break, and he asked me to come in and fill in for the next 2 days, today, Monday, and tomorrow, Tuesday. If you have thoughts, give us a call at 237-5948, or you can send us texts at short code 35270. For this entire hour, we have Dr. Thomas Ambrosio of NDSU. Dr. Ambrosio is a professor of political science and criminal justice here in Fargo, and he's also the director of the NDSU International Studies major, and he is an expert on something known as irredentism. That's a term you don't get to hear very often.
No, you don't.
Tell us what irredentism is.
Irredentism comes from the Italian irredenta, which means unredeemed. And it came about as an idea in which the Italians were gathering the Italian lands. So you had this growing state of Italy that was basically trying to grab all the Italians that were in other countries and bring it into a greater Italy. They were unsuccessful in some cases, but successful in most of them. So we saw this take place, for example, in Yugoslavia, in which Yugoslavia collapses, and then Serbia tries to create a greater Serbia, and then Croatia tries to create a greater Croatia at the expense of Bosnia. And I actually have a book on this called Irredentism, and it came out, unfortunately, on 9/11. In the 1990s, everyone cared about ethnic conflicts, and then on 9/11, everyone
cared about up by international
terrorism. But it's interesting to see it coming back now, because essentially what we have in with Russia and Crimea is another case of irredentism.
So Putin,
yes,
is an irredentist.
Yes, he is trying to regather the Russian lands. And what's interesting is we're seeing this shift under Putin in terms of what is Russia. There's one of my old professors used to say, what is Russia? What is foreign? What is policy? When we talked about Russian foreign policy. And the biggest question was, what is Russia? And we actually use the wrong term for Russia. We call it Russia, but it's actually Rossiya, which is not really ethnic in nature. Ruski is ethnic. And the reason why I say that is that we're starting to see Putin use this term. So trying to gather the Russians who were in other territories into a greater Russia.
And of course, the Russian USSR collapsed in 1991. Mm-hmm. And Russia shrank from its widest extreme to a much narrower Russia.
Right.
And now Putin is apparently attempting to repick some of the pieces and add them back to the Russian Federation. Is that
right?
Correct?
Right. Some of these territories that went away, like Crimea, is a great example. Of course, you've seen the annexation of that this last week. This was a territory that is now predominantly populated by Russians, ethnic Russians. Who were moved in after the local Muslim ethnic group was largely massacred and kicked out.
And when did that happen?
That happened under Stalin, right after World War II. You had the ethnic Tartars, who were a Turkish type of people, and they were expelled and sent to Siberia, and most of them died. So then a lot of Russians moved in. But then in 1954, this province was given to Ukraine as a gift by Nikita Khrushchev.
But Ukraine was also associated
with the
USSR.
Was also part of the Soviet Union, right. And but the Russians kind of always wanted it back. So Putin has taken the first slice back. And the question then becomes, where does he stop?
Yeah, so first of all, very basically,
yep.
When this all began to break a couple of weeks ago, I will admit I had to go to my atlas and remind myself of where Crimea is. Of course, we've heard about it, the Crimean War, the Light Brigade, et cetera.
Yep, Charger Light Brigade.
But you kind of forget where it is. Tell us where
right.
It is.
The Crimea is the northern part of the Black Sea. So if you take out your atlas, if you look towards the east of Europe, you have the big Black Sea there. Countries like Romania, Bulgaria, Turkey border it. And it is a peninsula right just kind of south of Ukraine. Only connected by a land bridge of about 4 miles.
It's the Isthmus of Perikope?
Yes.
And it's a 3.5 mile
or something really, yeah.
Isthmus that connects this Crimea, which is 10,000 square miles, to Ukraine.
To Ukraine, right.
And then to the east
is
a section
proper.
Of Russia.
Right, is Russia proper.
And why is Crimea so important to Russia?
I don't think Crimea does have some physical importance. It is the location of the Russian Black Sea Fleet.
And they need that because?
Because Russia is does not have a warm water port.
It's essentially landlocked
right.
Because its ports are in the Arctic.
It's ports are in the Arctic, and they freeze up in winter, and there really aren't any good other ports in the Black Sea.
So strategically, this makes a kind of sense.
Right, but on the other hand, it's not about strategic importance, or about even the Russians themselves were living there.
What's about?
It is about pride. I would ask your listeners to go. You can actually go to the Russian president's website and look at Putin's speech that he gave when he announced the annexation of Crimea. And it's really incredible because it goes through, in some detail, Russia's grievances against the United States and the West.
Russia collapsed.
Right. So what happens is that the Soviet Union collapses in 1991. Russia's empire is gone. This is an empire they had spent centuries building.
And not just under communist rule,
right,
for centuries.
Going all the way back to the czars. And I always tell my students this. If you think about what the Russians lost in the western part of their country, they lost about 300 years of conquest. Imagine where America would be if we lost everything we had 300
California,
years ago.
California, Arizona, Texas.
Well, 300 years ago.
We'd be in Jamestown.
Right. We'd be at the foothills of the Appalachians at best.
So their pride was deeply wounded.
Right. And this idea that Russia sees itself as a great power, sees itself as a necessary kind of balancer in the international system, really came to a head under Putin. And basically, in this speech, he basically says, we're back. We are back, and this is about national pride. It's about who we are. And you're seeing Putin's popularity numbers go up.
In Russia, they're skyrocketing.
Yeah,
for this.
Because even though the economy is starting to go down, even though the long-term future of Russia is poor, I would say, the Russians now have a sense of pride. They're back.
Now, they've been rumbling along these lines for a number of years, but from 1991 till just a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. they had been in this kind of shrunken, humiliated state of regrouping.
Right. Well, especially in the 1990s under Yeltsin. And then when Putin comes into power, actually at New Year's Eve, when Yeltsin mysteriously and very quickly kind of announced his resignation, Putin becomes president. And he begins this process of strengthening the state that had largely collapsed under Yeltsin. And then from there, he starts asserting himself on the international stage. So in 2008, there was a small war between Russia and Georgia, in which the Russians kind of moved down, kind of beat the Georgians a bit, and then kind of retreated back to the territories that they've, in essence, annexed of Georgia. And again, showing that they're back. But this is the real big step where they're actually going into a sovereign country, taking its territory and annexing it and bring it into Russia.
So what they've done is this very bold thing.
Yeah.
Using terms that Hitler used in the Sudetenland, they're saying there are Russian ethnics in Crimea. It's part of the Russian Empire. We're taking it, and you can't do a thing about it.
And we not only can't we do a thing about it, we're not going to do a thing about it. We put some sanctions on some individuals, but ultimately there's very little we can do at this stage.
So this happened, and this could be a slippery slope, because what would be the logical next steps if Putin thinks he got a green light from the West?
Right. The logical next step for Putin would be to look at the ethnic map of Ukraine. I love ethnic maps because they show you what's really going on inside the borders. And you would see that eastern Ukraine and southern Ukraine, southeastern Ukraine, are mixed areas and largely Russian. So if you're going to annex Russians in one place, you might want to think about annexing Russians in another place. And you've already started to see some violence. The Russians say it's Ukrainian fascists provoking it. Everyone else in the world says that it's Russians coming in and provoking it, in which you create a crisis and then you present yourself as a country that's going to save.
As the stabilizing country.
Right.
Hold that thought. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you where other Russian ethnic enclaves would be that Russia might want to take. Welcome back to the Mike McFeely Show here on KFGO. I am having a conversation with Dr. Thomas Ambrosia of NDSU Political Science and Criminal Justice. He literally wrote the book on irredentism, and we're talking about Crimea, Ukraine, and the Russian Empire. Dr. Ambrosia, I mean, in a certain sense, from a purely rational point of view, you could say that Putin has a point, that if there is a majority, I think 61% of the Crimean people are Russian, why shouldn't he say that the Russians deserve to be under the same boundary?
Well, that would be what his argument would be. The danger in that kind of thinking is that lots and lots of countries have the same situation.
For example, California, Mexico.
California, Mexico. Lots of countries where you have these ethnic groups that are across borders. And when you start messing with borders, you really start moving away from peace. And then you start to create crises. And you have a situation like in Yugoslavia where, as the Serbian military leader said, borders are drawn with blood. And that is essentially what they did in Yugoslavia, was try to draw new borders in blood. And the idea is that the status quo, even if it's unjust, even if it leads groups across an international border from their homeland, it's better to have that kind of for peace purposes rather than kind of justice. So we always have that tension in international law and international politics, but usually we fall on one.
So we get it that the Soviet Union collapsed, that there was this period of uncertainty and national humiliation, and now there's regrouping under Putin, and he is having a kind of forward and ambitious policy of rebuilding what he thinks he can get away with of the historic Russian Empire. He's a rational actor, right?
It makes
sense. And he's done this bold thing, and he's gotten away with it. What's next?
Well, there's a couple of questions about what's next. Certainly, Eastern Ukraine, I think, is in play right now.
And we see the maps where there is a large percentage of Russian nationals.
You're starting to see members of, like, for example, the head of NATO right now came out. The Ukrainian foreign defense minister came out and said, Russia's starting to mobilize on the Ukrainian border, and they might decide to go in. There's also ethnic Russians in northern Kazakhstan, though... If I was Kazakh in Kazakhstan, I'd be a little bit nervous looking at what they did in Crimea. Also, there's a territory in eastern Moldova, which is called Transnistria, which is one of these great places. It's kind of like a Soviet theme park. The Soviet Union collapsed, and they still kind of held on to the Soviet Union in many ways. And that has been kind of detached from Moldova since the early 1990s. But there's been some thought that maybe Russia might start moving in.
Do you or do you not think that Putin will march on Ukraine?
At this point, I would not be surprised if he did. The question is, where does he stop?
Right. So he takes Ukraine or parts of Ukraine. Go to the Baltics. I mean, I understand it, during the Soviet period, the Soviets placed a lot of Russian nationals in the Baltic states.
Yes. After World War II, a lot of Russian nationals were moved into the Baltic states, in particular in Estonia and Latvia, and some in Lithuania as well.
Right.
And... there's been tensions there as well.
And however, been rumbling about the need to protect Russian interests in those former Soviet provinces.
Right. In fact, even from the mid-2000s, he was kind of making these rumblings. The difference there than with Ukraine, and this is kind of a complete horse of a different color, is the fact that the United States has a treaty with these countries. These countries are members of NATO, Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. They are members of NATO, and we have an obligation to defend those countries if they're attacked. So historically what we've seen with Russia is that they will go as far as they want or as they can until they're stopped, until they meet a superior opponent, and then they tend to back off. They've done this historically going back hundreds of years, and this is one of the great things about studying Russian foreign policy, is that it's a real consistent. So I can't imagine Putin would do anything with the Baltics because of that treaty. Ukraine, Moldova, those are very, very different. And I can see something happening there.
And what about the underbelly of the former Soviet Union, all of those Islamic states that are now independent nations?
Right. They've already seized parts of Georgia. Now, Georgia's not Islamic, but they've seized the Muslim parts of Georgia, two areas called South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And I was actually... on the bridge in between Georgia proper and Abkhazia a couple years ago, where there was Russian troops on the other side. They've already essentially seized those territories. And then there's Russians in northern Kazakhstan. But Kazakhstan has largely accepted the fact that they're going to be dominated by Russia. And there's no place else for them to go. So they've kind of worked out a deal with Russia. So that would be very, very different. But no, Russia has made it very clear that the former Soviet Union, except for the Baltic states, the former Soviet Union is their sphere of influence, and they are going to dominate that region. And any attempt to go in there is going to be met with force in one way or another. We've seen this with Ukraine, we've seen it with Georgia, and we've seen it in other places as well.
So you said they will continue until they're stopped by a
Most
superior
likely, yes.
countervailing force.
Right.
What does that look like? It doesn't sound like sanctions against a few high-level Russian officials.
No. I think if Putin decides to go further, it will go until he hits that NATO sign, essentially, this area protected by NATO. And then I think at that point, it will be too far for him to go.
But that means that he probably gets much of Ukraine and Moldavia.
He may decide to say, let Western Ukraine go. We don't care about that because those are pure Ukrainians. The eastern part is largely Russian. The middle part is mixed. But for Russia as a concept or as a whole, as a nation, Kiev is the heart of their civilization. So if you're going to go in, you might as well go. Kind of go big or go home.
In other words, Kiev is not in the Russian ethnic zone, but it's
in a mixed area, but it's real important historically for them.
And, okay, there's a certain kind of Russian logic to this.
Mm-hmm.
The West is in a war-weary state. We've been in Iraq. We've been in Afghanistan. NATO is not what it once was. There is a kind of presumption that there will never be a tank-based shooting war in that part of the world. So what does a countervailing force look like that stops Russia from expansion?
Well, I think there are two possible things. One is, again, is NATO not wanting to risk a confrontation with NATO. And the Russians have not done that up to this point. Risk that confrontation. The other thing would be if the Ukrainians decide to really fight back. And what we've seen thus far is that the Ukrainians have not fought back. They've largely let Russia come in almost unopposed. However, the Ukrainians have been mobilizing some troops and moving them towards the east. So that may be different. But the Russians could overwhelm the Ukrainians very, very quickly.
You know, we're going to come back after the break. I want to ask you many more questions, but I know you can't look happily on this situation, but as a professor of political science, it's sort of like a golden moment for you, too.
It is, and it's great for my students, too, because they get to see real-world application to some of the things they're studying in class.
Yeah, and so this is something that's an unfolding crisis in the world's arena. When we come back after the break, I want to ask you about the response so far by NATO and the response so far by the United States. And welcome back to the Mike McFeely Show. I'm your guest host today and tomorrow, Clay Jenkinson. We're talking with Dr. Thomas Ambrosio of NDSU, professor of political science and criminal justice. He wrote a book called Irredentism, Ethnic Conflict and International Politics. Irredentism is when a country wants to pull back the pieces that it lost. And if ever there was an irredentist, it's Putin. Dr. Ambrosio, I got an email during the break from a Tom, and he said this, and this I think is in the minds of lots of people in North Dakota. Would Putin have dared to do what he did if G.W. Bush was still president? I don't think so, says Tom. To me, this is a direct result, or at least illicitly permissible, because Obama did a reset with Putin and tried to be best buddies with him. What does your guest think?
Well, there's a couple of things there, actually, that are kind of interesting. One is that Putin already did something similar, not annexing fully with Georgia in 2008 when Bush was still president. This, I think, is something that's been a long time coming, that we're seeing this larger shift in American power, where in the 1990s, we were the most powerful country, relatively speaking, the world has ever seen. We had global interest, global reach, and there was no one who could compete with us. And we've seen this process, which has become accelerated over the last couple of years, and accelerating almost at a faster rate, kind of like tipping something over, and then at a certain point, it tips all the way really quickly. We're seeing this under Obama. And in part, I think it's due to policies. In part, it's due simply to the natural process that America's simply war-weary. We don't want to do this anymore. We have serious economic problems at home. Our economy still has not recovered, despite what we have here in North Dakota, which is kind of a world unto itself. And so I think it's accelerating now in terms of this process. Now, the whole thing with the reset is really funny. I think one of the problems that the Obama administration had is that it came into office believing all the problems in the world were George W. Bush.
Which is a mistake, of course. Right. These are systemic problems.
Exactly. And that's how I would look at it, as something that's larger trend that predated Bush, that it dated Bush, and then will go on
so
after
one
him.
Of Obama's illusions is a nice man with high ideals wanting to right. get along in the world and not being a bully like his predecessor is going to have a sweet reign. He was wrong.
Well, in essence, he said to the Russians with this whole reset, and even they translated it wrong, which is kind of funny, the actual reset button. But they basically were saying, look, George Bush isn't president anymore. That was why we had problems. now we can be friends again. And that was wrongheaded. And I think it was wrongheaded.
Why is it wrongheaded?
I think it was wrongheaded because it didn't understand why Russia acted the way it did. It was acting because of its sense of pride. And the pattern of Russia opposing the United States started under Clinton in the mid-1990s. People forget about what happened in Kosovo and when the United States went to war with Serbia in order to essentially take Kosovo away from Serbia, which is similar to what Putin did to Crimea, which, of course, there's a lot of differences between the two in terms of human rights abuses, but Putin has used that as justification. So U.S.-Russian problems began before George Bush became president. And this idea, well, now we have a new president, everything's going to be fine, to me, that was just simply wrongheaded. And the now former ambassador, Michael McFaul, was kind of the person who pushed that, and it did not go well for him.
So in spite of the kind of narcissism and the illusions of the Obamaites, that it's a new world in which peace and negotiation are going to prevail, and dumping all of the problems of the world on the aggressions of the Bush administration. That was wrong, you're saying. On the other hand, you're also saying, I think, that Tom is pushing it a little too far
yes.
Russia would have been doing this irrespective of who's in the presidency of the United States.
Well, if McCain was president, McCain kind of a loose cannon, maybe not. But I think we've already seen this Russian assertiveness that was during George W. Bush. So I don't think it's I just think the process has now continued at a faster rate under Obama. And I'm sure the next president, whoever that will be, will see similar things pop up in other places that will test him or her, depending on who's president.
So let's leave American domestic party politics out of it. And you're the president of the United States, or I'm the president of the United States. What are our options?
Our options are very, very limited. I think
that, no matter who you are.
Right, no matter who you are. I think if Bush was president, we'd probably be doing the same thing. We've put sanctions on Russia. Now, these are sanctions that were done by the president, which means they're easy to pull back. They're not written into law, which is what some members of Congress wanted. And these are targeted sanctions against individuals, not Putin himself, but people around him. The idea is you kind of squeeze them to hopefully squeeze Putin. That's not going to work. They know it's not going to work. But they're doing this in order to show their displeasure. And I think that it's more symbolic than it is actual. There's some other things we can do. The EU signed an association agreement with Ukraine. We're going to probably ramp up our cooperation with Ukraine in terms of military cooperation. But in terms of like sending in troops and saying, don't come in, that's not going to happen.
Not yet. At some future push of Putin, we may reach that point.
If Putin decides to kind of go for it all, but I don't think.
But the European community is ambivalent about this because, of course, it's utterly dependent upon Russian carbon.
Right.
And they know that if Putin gets really angry, he can cut off their natural gas supplies and oil supplies, and that would have a very destabilizing effect on Western Europe.
Exactly. Especially natural gas is very difficult to – it's not nearly as portable or
as fungible.
You can't put
it in a tanker. Right.
Right. It's not as fungible as, say oil is. And you have this interdependence, but when one country is willing to press that – and it's not really as much interdependence as dependence in the sense that Europe is much more dependent. So you have that going on. In addition to that, you have Europe's kind of general tendency not to confront problems.
And right, they're in kind of a post-aggression era.
Right, they're in the land that just everyone's happy. And everything works the way it does in Brussels, where people negotiate and they write papers and they sign documents that people follow through on.
But there's nothing contemptible about that.
No, it's worked for them. But it's worked for them in large part because
the world's been at peace.
The world's been at peace and the United States gave them security.
Right.
But now that the United States is pulling back, Europe's finding itself without this U.S. protector, and it has not stepped up in the way it needs to.
Let me ask you a question about one form of American response. So one thing we did was to freeze assets of a certain number of high Russian officials, and I was in Europe while this was happening, and the word there was that this was a pretty serious thing because these people liked to vacation and go to Paris and go to Berlin and go to London. And they had houses and investments there. And so this was not negligible. This was going to hurt a few people. But then, you know, the Russians countered with McCain and Boehner,
right,
and so on. And John Boehner said something that I thought was really wrongheaded, and particularly in view of what you've just said about pride, because he said, oh, yeah, I guess I'll have to cancel my vacation in Siberia. That sense that the Soviet Union is a contemptible place that no one would want to visit touches on the very pride that you're talking about.
Right. And I think that there's one of the main responses that I think we're doing, which may backfire, is this idea of telling Russia you're not important anymore.
Right. That's a terrible mistake, I think.
Which, you know, kicking them out of the G8 for, or getting rid of the G8 and going back to the G7, which is the seven industrialized democracies. And Russia really should never have been brought in anyway, but that's another.
But kicking them out is a terrible mistake because you want engagement, don't you?
But then it also gives Russia a platform, though. So you don't want to give Russia the
new
platform.
Grievance.
Well, you don't want to give Russia the platform in order to say you're still one of us. I'm not actually convinced it's a bad idea.
You think maybe we should?
Yeah, to say, look, the G7 is about democracies. And the G8 was done under Clinton, I think for good intentions, to say, to try to help Yeltsin develop the democracy in Russia. But at this point, Russia is not a democracy. And I think we should just kind of give up the sham of that. And the fact that the G8 summit was supposed to be in Russia this year is a perfect excuse to say, we're not going to do it. You're not really part of us. You know, China's not in, even though they have the second largest economy in the world, because they're not a democracy. So I'm not sure it's bad. But yeah, I mean, some of the response by Congress has not, I'm not sure how it's been, it hasn't really been helpful. But ultimately, the Russian pride issue is one that we're going to have to deal with. And we have to at least understand where they're coming from. And it's not that we have to accept them. We have to understand why they feel the sense of grievance, even if it's wrong. Even if objectively it's wrong, we have to understand why they feel that way and try to figure out ways to make them happy.
We're going
to
take
but not give in to them.
We're going to take a short break when we come back with Dr. Ambrosio. Welcome back to the Mike McFeely Show. I'm your guest host, Clay Jenkinson, and sitting across from me is Dr. Thomas Ambrosio, who's been giving us a fascinating analysis of what's happening in Crimea, Ukraine, and the Black Sea area of the former Soviet Union. You know, there are a lot of Ukrainians in North Dakota. I come from the Ukrainian belt out in western North Dakota. I actually had a Ukrainian wedding reception just north of Belfield. And so Ukraine really matters in this place. And its territorial sovereignty and integrity are in serious jeopardy.
Right. It really is. Again, if Putin decides to go into eastern Ukraine, then Ukraine itself will cease to exist as this kind of post-Soviet version of itself. And I think we'll be largely left with, again, depending on how far it goes, with Western Ukraine, kind of the true ethnic Ukrainians and not this mixed region.
And I've been reading a little bit about this in the international press. And one of the analyses is that Ukraine has been so badly managed over the past decade with a kleptocracy and corruption and so on, not really having its act together, that they made it easier for Putin to do what he's done. If they had really had a vibrant nation that was moving forward, this might have been less easy. Is that fair?
Ukraine has really been really cursed by its leadership. I mean, from the very beginning under Kuchma and all the way through, they've had really, really bad leaders. And maybe in 2004 with the Orange Revolution, things could have been different. But then we had the fracture of the Orange Coalition, in which you had the eventual winner going up against his prime minister. And it just fractured that and gave rise to the now deposed president, Viktor Yanukovych, who was very much, much more pro-Russian, and which is what started all this when he decided to sign the agreement with Russia rather than the EU.
Now, Crimea is a place of 10,000 square miles. It's a peninsula on the Black Sea. It's a flashpoint in the world. There have been wars there. Lots of other nations empires have occupied Crimea.
Right. It's been this area that's been important. We had the Crimean War even before that, when the Russians had gone in.
The Ottoman Empire was big there.
This is an important territory. But in the current time, I think it's much more about kind of Russia as Russia rather than the territory itself.
So you are less concerned about the geopolitical and the strategic issues than you are about the pride of Russia and the irredentism of the...
Well, I think that's what's really more motivating it. But I think in the larger geopolitical sense, this is part of a clearer sign that the American kind of Pax Americana is declining. You've seen this before. certainly, I think Syria was our wake-up call that America was not going to step in and solve the world's problems. And people had complained, oh, America's too overbearing. Well, we stopped doing it, and then you have Syria. I think this is just another sign of that larger trend. And I think this is a new world order we have to get used to where we can't solve things, where all the problems in the world. If there's a crisis, you can't say, why isn't Obama doing something? Well, it's maybe not our role anymore.
But Tom, who wrote in, would say if Bush were in the presidency, he would assert ourselves and that this would check Putin before he goes further?
I'm not sure about that. One of the great things, or the problems of political science, we can't run experiments. And I would love to be able to. But yeah, I think that Bush would have had a similar response because no one wants a shooting war with Russia. This is not an area in which we're willing to expend significant blood and treasure.
Okay, so we're going to run out of time shortly. I want to ask you a couple questions. One is about ratcheting up. So we stop some assets and we've made some noise. The G7 may replace the G8, et cetera. At some point, this goes higher. And a question from Larry comes in saying, what about our space station? We're utterly dependent upon the Russians to put people on the space station. We have no vehicle that can do it. They could easily stop that, right?
They could. You could have this kind of back and forth where we do things and the Russians do things. And we have something like the Cold War, but it's not another Cold War. It's not a Cold War 2.0 because Russia's not the Soviet Union. They're far weaker. But you could have this kind of going back and forth where Russia's not creating solutions, they're creating problems. And Russia's always been very good at what I like to say, punching above their weight class, of playing a weak hand. They've always been good at this, and they could create problems for us.
Their weak hand has worked out for them so far.
It has. I mean, they're creating problems in Syria and other places, and they can create more problems for us. And for them, creating a problem for the United States is good.
If you look at something like Syria, I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong, but part of what motivates Russia is just stopping America from being the hegemon.
Exactly. It's about standing up. And that is where the sense of pride comes from. And now it's not just standing up or stopping America. Now it's moving a little bit forward.
But talking about anniversaries, this is the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War One.
That's right. The true forgotten war in America.
It was a relatively minor event that led to the greatest war the world had ever seen. People before the war broke out in August of 1914 said it'll never happen. If it happens, it's a short war. We can't imagine countries killing each other in large numbers. And then it turned into a Holocaust. What prevents this from ratcheting up until it's a war?
I think the lessons of World War One and World War Two.
You think we're in a post-war zone?
No, not that we're in a post-war zone, but the people in World War One didn't know what war truly looked like. And now we do. So the mindset of war is this glorious activity, this short burst of conflict, and then everyone gets a ride on the victory float. We know that that's not true. We know the true cost of war. Whereas in 1914, they were very naive about what would happen. Though if you look back at it, it was inevitable.
It had been building a long time.
And it was just a matter of time.
But doesn't this play into Putin's hands? So if for you and for me, it's unthinkable that tanks roll into Ukraine from the West. Putin surely knows this, that it would take a very, very high trigger for the West to respond militarily.
Absolutely. And this is one of the problems of kind of this post, you know, kind of Cold War order in which aggression pays unless someone's willing to stand up to you. America had stood up before, and we're not there anymore.
And we can't think of a real war against Russia. I mean, that could go nuclear.
It could go nuclear.
But just we're talking about a major power now, not Iraq, not even Iran.
Right.
We're talking about one of the world's great powers.
Right. It is a very, very different story. So, you know, we're seeing the rise of a country like China, Russia, where you have these countries that are not aligned with us ideologically. These are authoritarian regimes. And they are ones we're going to have to deal with in kind of this new world order. That's not going to be as easy as it was kind of the free ride of the 90s.
Theodore Roosevelt would probably say to avoid the war, you have to be prepared actually to go to war. In other words, that's going to be the checking point.
If you want peace, prepare for war. But I'm not sure we are really even willing to prepare for that.
We're down to a few seconds. Tell us where we can get your book, Irredentism.
You can get on Amazon.com. So that's
where I would
go.
You can buy the book. It came out, unfortunately, on the 9/11. Day of 9/11.
Yes. You can get it. Some people think you can take things out of the NDSU Public Library or NDSU Library. You can get it there, too.
In 5 seconds, what are you working on now?
I'm working on how authoritarian regimes keep themselves in power.
And right up your alley. You're listening to the Mike McFeely Show. Our guest has been Dr. Thomas Ambrosio, a